You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning, and our heat wave is over, officially. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations land, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. This is something we are going to continuously remind us of, that we are on First Nations land, and we are focusing very much on the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. I would like to welcome those of you who are new, and those of you who are away for a while, and those of you who are just here because you're here.
Many of you will have seen the red dresses hanging on the trees as you came in today, and some people here in the congregation are wearing red dresses. We're participating in a project that is to draw the attention of everyone to the missing and murdered Aboriginal women that this country has seemed to lose track of over the course of the last 30 years. 1,200 women have gone missing and been murdered during that 30 years, and we have yet to have the political will to enter into an investigation of why that is so and what we can do to prevent it. The Red Dress Project is a project of Jamie Black, a Winnipeg Métis artist, who in 2012 began gathering red dresses and hanging them in public installations to commemorate these women's lives. Her work has been shown in various settings across the country, but this year she invited everyone to be part of that project. And so we have at West Hill, we sent out in the e-blast some news about that, and we've shared the word amongst us so that we could bring our red dresses or wear them today. I'm wanting to record what it is that is lost when we lose one of our sisters, and they're all our sisters. And so I'm hoping that perhaps what the word red evokes for you might bring to us some of what it is that has been lost. And so I'm going to ask you, and Donna is recording these words for us, I'm going to ask you to just call out a word that the color red symbolizes or evokes in you. Passion, mother, life, anger, warmth, stress, celebration, sorry?
Kiss.
Oh, kiss. I'm sorry, Jim? Fire, thank you. Blood. It's often in films, it often denotes the spirit. Brilliance. Beauty, roses, strength.
Stop.
I'm sorry?
Stop.
Yes, that's a good word for this. Happiness. The Red River. Embarrassment. Blood. Sunrise and sunset. Thank you. These lives that have been lost and families who have a child or a mother-shaped hole in them miss so many of those things that you have shared, including words like anger and stop, because those lives have been lost and they move on without them. The name of the project, the Red Dress Project, the word is put together in the word redress, which, as you know, means to rectify, to remedy, to straighten something out, and that is the work that we hope to be part of as we demonstrate with our red dresses. So our special celebration today, I'd like those who are wearing red dresses in honor of this to stand, if you would. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. May we continue to honor our sisters who are lost and find ways that we can bring them back to us, if only through a process that will bring them some justice. Emily is going to share with us a song, which is an incredible song and one that has a lot of meaning for a number of people, particularly when they find themselves in situations where it takes more than just getting up to face a day. And it takes energy, it takes a fierce determination. As we begin our service, let us be aware that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommended 94 calls to action to address the legacy of residential schools and advance the process of Canadian reconciliation. Our call to action this morning is number 5. We call upon the federal, provincial, and territorial, and Aboriginal governments to develop culturally appropriate parenting programs for Aboriginal families.
Grounded, guided, growing. A time for centering. From Scott Kearns.
The bottom line there says a time for centering, and that's what we choose to do. Not that you're uncentered before this, but intentionally. And that's really what we do. Some of the things we do here we do all week, but here we do them together and we do them intentionally. And so if you could turn to the next slide. That's not easy to see, is it? It was at home. It's not so much now. But I wanted to just take it apart for a minute. Some of you are very familiar with this, and others, for others, it may be new. But the grounded, the green, grounded in life, what we mean when we try to explain that is that when everything else falls apart, when you don't know anything, when nothing's making sense, what do you center yourself back into? What truth, what reality? And we found that bedrock idea in the fact that life is real and it is connected and interconnected, and that's what we're part of. So we are grounded in life. Each one of us is part of that interconnected web, that amazing, beautiful, fearful, powerful, intricate web of life. That's our grounding. And because of that, we look around and say, how shall we live? And we try here over and over to center ourselves back to say we choose love whenever possible. We make that choice. So can you see the red there? Guided by love, both justice and compassion, because love is not just a nice little feeling. If it was, us when we get grouchy would take a pass on it, but it's justice and compassion. And then how to do that better, because I don't and you don't always do that beautifully. We grow in wisdom together. And the reason for all that is that bottom line there, growing in wisdom for living. See, it goes back to the green. Isn't that cool? And then life goes back to the red, lovingly. With self, so how to treat yourself compassionately and respectfully. How to treat others who you know, others you don't know, and others in the seventh generation beyond us and the whole planet with justice and compassion. So that's what we do. I'm going to play an early American folk tune a couple of times as you center into those big, strong, dependable truths. And then we'll sing our sharing song. Thank you.
Not one of us has had the same week as anyone else sitting in this place. Some of us have had phenomenal weeks. Some of us have had horrific weeks. Some of us have had those weeks that sort of go up and down between, you know, maybe muted versions of those two things. But we come here into this place slightly different from wherever we were last Sunday morning, whether it was in this place or somewhere else. Because that life that has impacted us, that has touched us, that has shifted and changed us, has made sure that we are not the same as we were last week. If we were the same as we were last week, life would not continue on. And so each week when we come here, we seek to bring a little bit of that transformed, renewed, different, slightly more broken person into this place so that we can see that person here, so that we can honor you by reflecting you back to you, not the perfect scrubbed clean Sunday morning smiling you, because that's just a little piece of you, but all of you, so that you can see who you really are in this place, so that you can be who you really are in this place, and affirmed in that by us because we love in this place. You can then go out from this place stronger, more committed to those values of being grounded in life, guided by love and growing in wisdom. And you go with us with you. So we gather in this time that we call sharing, which is a time in which we invite vulnerability, which we invite us to be open with one another, to share who we really are. And to name those things that are important to us, that move us, that mold our hearts, those things we're really grounded in. 'Cause sometimes it's real murky stuff, and it needs to be named, and to name those things that really inspire us. Each week, we do this in community, beginning by naming those places in the world or in our community that are in difficult places, experiencing chaos or conflict, groups that, for whatever reason, are consistently denied rights, rejected by the world in one way or another. And we name those places or those groups into this space so that we can carry them from here in our hearts, in everything that we do, and make sure that they are not alone, that we find ways to be present to them. So I invite you to name, just from where you are, just calling out into the space, those groups or those places that have been on your heart this week that you feel we might all hold close to us. May we find a way to take these people into our hearts, so that our hearts are stretched to the point that every choice that we make, they're there with us. They're in our choices. They're in the ways that we live. And may we find our way alongside them toward their hope. In this, our time of need. Amen. And now I invite you to a more individual reflection on these things that lift your heart, or these things that draw your attention because they challenge you or the people close to you. There are microphones on either side of the hall, and I have one here for you. And you're invited to conclude whatever it is that you offer into this space with in this abundant blessing or in this our time of need, and I figure you'll know which one of those to use. But we use in this our time of need because if you are in a time of need, it's ours. We are interconnected, and so your need is our need, and that's why we use that word when we come together in this way. So I would invite you to speak, to offer who you are into the space so that we might be present to you and reflect you back to you completely. Now we traditionally, each week, having moved through naming those things that have caused our world harm and continue to. And speaking those things in our own lives that are gifts and our challenges. We move to naming the organizations that are doing things that we can be inspired by, who are putting their shoulders collectively to a wall, whatever that wall might be, and working to shift it so that people might have a greater abundance, might live with dignity, might be able to access the resources that they need to live with dignity. And so I invite you, just from where you are, as we did earlier, to name those places and those groups that are making a difference in the world and that inspire us as they do so. There is strength and beauty and goodness all around us, and all we have to do, as my mom would say, is open your eyes and see it. So when those moments arise that we feel there is no hope, that there's little that might inspire us toward creating a sustainable future for our life on the planet, we have but to open our eyes and look at those people, those organizations that are pouring their lives into the work of creating that world and of bringing hope. In this abundant blessing, we share the joy. And now I invite you to share with me the words that encapsulate who it is we are and how we choose to live in this place. As I live every day, I want to be a channel for peace. May I bring love where there is hatred and healing where there is hurt, joy where there is sadness, and hope where there is fear. I pray that I may always try to understand and comfort other people, as well as seeking comfort and understanding from them. Wherever possible, may I choose to be a light in the darkness, a help in times of need, and a caring, honest friend. And may justice, kindness, and peace flow from my heart forever. Amen.
Our reading today is from Wendell Berry, a novelist, a poet, a farmer, and an environmental activist. No settled family or community has ever called its home place an environment. None has ever called its feeling for its home place biocentric or anthropocentric. None has ever thought of its connection to its home place as ecological, deep or shallow. The concepts and insights of the ecologist are of great usefulness in our predicament, and we can hardly escape the need to speak of ecology and ecosystems. But the terms themselves are culturally sterile. They come from the juiceless, abstract intellectuality of the universities, which was invented to disconnect, displace, and disembody the mind. The real names of the environment are the names of rivers and river valleys, creeks, ridges and mountains, towns and cities, lakes, woodlands, lanes, roads, creatures, and people. And the real name of our connection to this everywhere different and differently named earth is work. We are connected by work even to the places where we don't work. For all places are connected. It is clear by now that we cannot exempt one place from our ruin of another. The name of our proper connection to the earth is good work. For good work involves much giving of honor. It honors the source of its materials. It honors the place where it is done. It honors the art by which it is done. It honors the thing that it makes and the user of the made thing. Good work is always modestly scaled, for it cannot ignore either the nature of individual places or the differences between places, and it always involves a sort of particularity. For it must be defined a little differently for every one of the places and every one of the workers on the earth. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Focused moment from Greta Vosper.
The focused moment each week is lifted off from the theme of the week. But the theme shifted and changed this week a number of times, most recently because of the Red Dress Project, which I only became aware of a couple of days ago. So I'm going to invite you, instead of hearing a focused moment, to close your eyes and allow me to take you to your own. You rise into a new day. And whether the sun shines hard shadows on the earth or merely offers light, we walk into that day carrying with us all that has gone before. We carry our homes. We carry our work. We carry our friends and relationships. We carry our history, splotchy and splattered as it is by the dissolution of memory and the perspective with which we hold it. We carry with us the gifts that have been given to us by those who love and hold us. An idea of goodness, the possibility of truth, the courage of something new, and the curiosity to gain it. We carry with us a strength that no one could measure. We carry with us whatever hope rests in our heart. With these, we walk into our day. Before us lies anything. The possibilities are exponential to the power of possibility, beyond the scope of our imagining, beyond anything that has ever been written or told or has ever unfolded. Anything that is good, anything that is bad, anything that is possible might unfold. But all we have is what we carry into it. And so may we. May we have the courage to know who we are. To try to wrestle with understanding where we came from. May we have the grace to accept what's been hard and has scarred us. And may we have the joy of sharing what has birthed beauty inside us. May we walk toward the exponential possibilities of possibility. May we do that with all that we are, opening ourselves to all that we might be. Amen. I'm looking for music here. There's no music happening. I mean, that was beautiful music. Oh, I thought that was an additional one. It's okay. Sorry. I know, I said I wanted that one, but I thought you'd still have one here. It's fine. It's okay. We can do this misunderstanding thing later, hon. It's good. We're good. You should have seen his face when I asked him to put the red dress on. It was like... I loved that reading that Elaine shared with us this morning. The reading, the work of Thomas Berry is voluminous. It's huge, it's deep, it's rich, it's poetic, it's brilliant, and it calls us back over and again to who we are, probably because of his relationship with the earth, probably because he wove himself into the earth as he turned it and planted and seeded and let it go fallow and then turned it again. His understanding of our relationship with Earth permeates everything that he writes. And we approach it, those of us whose relationship with the Earth is buffered by our work, by our food sources, by all kinds of things, we approach it with an, a sort of feeling that we have to get over something in order to touch what he's offering. Even when I walk on the path behind my home that is leads onto a green area, which we can afford because a train runs by it every now and then, I walk on asphalt. I walk out of my house in shoes with soles on a stone pathway onto some asphalt. I get in my car. I come here. I get on asphalt. I walk into the building. The number of times I actually touch the earth are rare. Those are rare moments for me. And so when I approach Thomas Berry's work, it's often with that distanced perspective of someone who is enjoying what someone else does over there, but I haven't really got my fingernails that dirty that recently. So when his words spoke to us today about two different things, the naming, the getting beyond the intellectual universitization of the places that we live, and offered that to us as a way to understand our connection with the earth, I loved that. Especially today when it's Worldwide Communion Sunday. I think about communion in terms of the things that we ingest, that we bring into our body, but that we do it in a way that recognizes how sacred that moment is. And not just the moment of taking food into our body, but the moment of sitting down with people who are doing it as well and showing our vulnerability. There's nothing more destructive in the world than eating, and we have to do it to stay alive. We are, by our very nature, destructive. And Thomas Berry knew that because he had to destroy the earth in order to make food that we would then ingest, destroying the food as we moved through life. So I loved the reading that he shared with us. The idea that places are named and that we come to know them as those names seems sort of, you know, routine to us. We live in Toronto. The river that runs by here is Rouge. There's Lake Ontario in front of our doors. And we don't actually think much about the places unless they're written on street signs or numbered along a highway or the town is named something. We can't actually sort our world very well anymore without those kind of indicators. If I wanted to get you from here to Babette's house, and I told you, well, you'll go down a little knoll and then you'll come up again and then just walk maybe, you know, 500 paces and you'll see some flashing lights and turn to the left and walk a little bit. It would be very hard to get you to Babette's place unless I was telling you what streets to go on to get there and what number her house was once we got there. One of the things that we all find so quaint and lovely when you get a letter from England or when you visit there is that the houses are named. There's lots of named houses. They're not just numbers on a street. We separate ourselves from our place, from the earth, through those names. Kaylee Bradley blogged about some of the place names and the ways they have been shifted and changed here in Toronto. But she brought to the fore Brian Friel's play called Translations. Early in the 19th century, England had gone over to Ireland to begin to survey and map the land there. And so they began the process of attaching English names to what had been known as Gaelic places. Named for what happened there or what it looked like or what people gathered there. And so the traditional names were taken away from the people who never actually learned the new names. But the words and the sound of them were close enough that they were accepted finally into the community, some of the ancient names perhaps having fallen away. We've done that too here in Canada as this land, which of course was settled long before the settlers ever arrived, was given names according to the work that it offered, the place that it looked like, the people who were there. And those names were, when we came with our survey tapes and our polls to put a street name on, some of them were assimilated into that as we became the dominant culture in this country. And so Kaylee has brought us some of those names and shared them with us. One of them is Spadina. How many people thought Spadina was an Italian name? Oh, I kind of did. Thank you for acknowledging that. It's actually an Anishinaabewan name that comes from Ishvadanai, which means place on a hill. And if you go up the full length of Spadina, you find yourself, you come to Davenport, which is at the top of that ridge that was the bank of what was known long ago as Iroquois Lake and is now simply a ridge. But that word was a traditional Anishinaabe word and has become part of our lexicon, but yet unknown and unrecognized. Much of the work of recognizing what those names were has been undertaken by a group called First Story Toronto, and my iPad is out in the lobby, and the app is open, so you can see, you can click on the little symbol, and it will tell you what the original name of that place was. Some of the other ones are Lake Ontario is named after a Wyandot or Haudenosaunee word for Great Lake, which maybe is why the Great Lakes were called Great Lakes, or Beautiful Lake. And Etobicoke is derived from an Anishinaabe word meaning place of the black alder. We have moved away from this understanding of the places of our earth, and I think as we do that, we move away from our understanding of the peoples in this world because we come up with these technical, university-ized names. But Thomas Berry also talks about, in the second half, Wendell Berry also talks in that piece, he moves from talking about place names to talking about our work in those places. Our relationship with those places is our work. And he notes that we can have good work as we relate with that earth in a positive way, which would bring us to our tables where we take part in that most destructive aspect of our nature and make it something beautiful by engaging it with family and friends, by placing it amongst us as an opportunity for coming to know one another, for sharing, for opening our homes and building relationship, for exposing a little bit more of who we are by sharing our day, our likes and dislikes, and putting all of that together in a place that we create as beautiful, even though it is that most destructive thing that we will ever do. It's beautiful because we do it. And that work of getting that food to the table, when you're close enough to it, as Wendell Berry was, when you get right down into that dirt, then putting what you put on the table has a very close connection to that. But I want to ask you what your favorite foods that you put on the table are. What are like, let's come up with five favorite foods that we put on the table. Squash. Potatoes. Dressing. Okay. How often do you do that? Okay. What's another one? Pumpkin pie. That's pretty. Sorry? All desserts. Okay, that's great. That's good enough. We've got some good things there. Okay, so let's go backward on those things and figure out how they got to your table. How does the squash and the potatoes and the desserts and the pumpkin pie and the stuffing get on your table? Somebody prepares it to put on the table. I mean, if Scott sat me down and plunked a squash in front of me, I kind of wonder, right? Someone prepares it and puts it on the table. So before they prepare it, what happens? Sorry? You have to buy it. You buy it. You buy it from the store, the farmer's market, perhaps. Many of us, most of us, get most of our food from grocery stores, right? And to get to the grocery store, it's got there by, you know, some kind of transport company that has brought it from perhaps the food terminal if it's produce or fruit. But if it's, you know, boxed stuffing, it's come from, it's not boxed. I know it's not boxed, but let's say it's boxed. It's never boxed. The pumpkin pie is never bought. It's always baked at home, as are the desserts. But if, say, if something was in a box like Cheerios or something like that, it comes from a factory where it's been processed from the natural food, which got there via some kind of transportation system. And the food is processed there. The packaging is made somewhere else, also gets there, or they may go somewhere else. They may have to go to China to be packaged. I don't know. Come back in, you know, one of those big Maersk, you know, 12 crane or 20 crane ships, and it ends up on our table from somewhere, someplace that had a name that meant something a long, long time ago. Earth. It's about Earth. We talk about this place as though it's our home. But if we look at the food that ends up on our plates, that comes from our home. And I think Kay said it. It's from the Earth. On Worldwide Communion Sunday, when Christian congregations around the world, I believe, are celebrating communion. Some of them do it every week, but those that don't sometimes specifically make an effort to on this Sunday. We're on our home on the earth. We've named that place, and we've divided it, and we've separated ourselves, moved all around it from that first home that we all knew in the Rift Valley. And we've separated ourselves from it bit by bit by bit. Until what ends up on our table sometimes, really, we don't even think about where it came from and the toil that went into putting it there. When we gather at our tables, as we do on this day here, symbolically, we sit down with people that we love. We sit down with people that we wrestle with on a daily basis. We sit down with people who bring out the best in us, and some of them sometimes bring out the worst in us. But we sit down with them because there's something that draws us together around food. I think it's because it brings us back to that most basic need that we have for nourishment. It reminds us that we all have that fragile, fragile need. And that when we come together and we eat even the most simple of meals, we're acknowledging that we share that together, that we share our vulnerability there, that we share the origins of our food, that we share our need. And together, in front of one another, we fill that need. We take care of it, exposing our greatest vulnerability to one another. So it is that around tables, we have that possibility to build on that vulnerability, to build on allowing people see who we really are. If they can see us take care of our most pressing need, as vulnerable as we are as we do it, then perhaps they can accept this about me too. Perhaps I can talk about my feeling about being alone, even though there's six people at the table. Or perhaps I can talk about the things that I lost in my youth that I don't think I'm ever going to get back. Or perhaps I can talk about how I felt when I met my husband, and I want that feeling every single day. Or perhaps I can talk about how I listened to some music on the subway and it made me cry and everybody was staring at me, but it was that beautiful anyway. Perhaps we can talk about our vulnerabilities, because we're doing the thing that we are most vulnerable about when we gather at tables. When we began all this, by which I mean coming together into communities where the people were called Christian because of the way they got together, when we began all this, gathering apart from everyone else and doing something different than everyone. When we began all this, when we started telling ourselves that we could do things in the world that didn't have to stand up to the order as it was being set down around us, but we could do things that actually were a little bit different and might make the world a better place for the people around us, if not for ourselves. When we began all this, We had a story that made sense. It was a story about how the world looked a way we didn't want it to look. It was filled with people who acted in ways we didn't want them to act. And we decided that we had to live differently. And so when we began all this, we started coming together around a meal. That's the first thing we did. We started getting together around a table where it didn't matter whether you were the person who put on the feast or whether you were somebody who couldn't bring anything. It didn't matter whether you were one of the people who towed the line perfectly or whether you were a total radical that anybody could hardly bear to have you at the table because of the things you were going to say. It didn't matter because at that table, we would share our vulnerabilities and we would share our dreams. And the dreams were lived out in those people coming together and being together in that way. They didn't have to talk about this place or that. They didn't have to get down deep into the dirt of the earth. They were already there. And they created home in that community. And over the course of time, the meal shifted and changed. And it became more formulaic. And then it became, fenced in for the privileged few. And many of us broke out of that closed table idea into an open table decades ago. But I don't know that we've got back to the truth of our vulnerability that we were trying to accept back then when we were bringing together those who had everything and those who had nothing and recognizing that we're all the same. I don't know that we have got back to that at the core of our being about how important it is. So at West Hill, when we come together for communion, and it doesn't happen a whole lot, we do gather around the table quite regularly, and that's a communion of sorts. But when we come here to remember that vulnerability, that we all have it, that we can stand before one another and own it, and we can, through it, try to make the world a better place. That's how this all began. And I hope that we keep moving forward as though that's the promise that we can bring to the world. The story that began that meal that brought us together in that first way is a story that is told around this world in so many different languages and so many different ways. Some of them far more formulaic than others, but I just want to bring into your mind, if it's not that story, I want to bring into your mind that meal where people came together, some of them excited and some of them brimming over with possibilities, some of them feeling powerful for the first time and some of them afraid, and some of them having the courage to look at the next day and decide that they were going to step into something huge, and some of them afraid that the next day might be the last day or the end of whatever it was they had hoped would happen. Just pull that meal together in your head and place yourself at the table. And let us break bread together, knowing that together we can make this world a better place. We can share what it is we have to give. And so I read to you the great thanksgiving that we use to focus ourselves as we come together in this meal. John, can you bring that in? Can you bring that over now? Thank you. Let us pray. We stand a world apart from those in other lands who, too, bow their heads in full and ripened gratitude for satisfaction such as ours, pains relieved, lessons learned, hopes renewed. Their eyes scan strange horizons. Feet scuff their presence upon distant soils. The meaning of the words with which their thanks is lifted is locked in tongues we may not comprehend. Their gods don't rise before us. There are no deities to whom we offer praise. but human hearts beat with a universal rhythm. They thrill at beauty, love, and grace. Pain stamps its matching stain on all our bodies. Hope, no matter whence it comes, feels much the same. We are the people of Pangaea. Once one, we've staggered far beyond our home, pushed apart by forces we cannot remember, to distances that saved us from our fractious selves. And we have soothed our solitudes by the stories we have told. They have whispered tales of privilege to us and stirred our hearts to fear those within whom our common blood flows. The time has come for our reunion. Far stronger than our differences, what makes us one? Our love, our tears, our hungers pulls us back toward each other. Our mythic, writhing stories, useless to the challenges we face, now start to fade. Their hold upon us loosens, and we are freed to cast new dreams into a future we will never see. May those visions shine humility before us, reverence as we ponder one another's lives. May they humble us by what we hold in common, teach us truth and give us strength to hear it told. And may new legends call us forth to grandeur, to living large and wonder-filled and free. And may they build within us a pledge to seeing in all a sacred beauty. Only we, as the people of Pangaea, can name. May our challenges be answered only with compassion and respect. And may our future be filled with thanksgivings offered by those who walk together in dignity and love. Only we can make it so. Amen. We break these loaves to recognize our vulnerability, common as it is amongst us, and to recognize that standing amongst it, we can share who we truly are with one another, and so build a world built not just on vulnerability, but on love, on sharing, and on hope. I invite you now to join us in our communal feast as it once was served when all this began. Can we get that song? Huh? Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
I'm going to sing it through one time.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Break bread with me.
everyone gets a piece of bread and enjoys it, but the feast is the communion meal. It's the moment that we share together, so I invite you to enjoy the lunch and enjoy one another around it.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.